Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible. We're glad that you're tuning in. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. We're in a special edition series of podcasts here talking about preaching our way through Lent. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Well, we're back at it today. We're going to talk about this second Sunday in Lent. We are in year C. And as we got our series kicked off, we're really focusing, thinking about preaching specifically, beginning to construct the sermons a little bit, and of course, primarily focusing around the gospel text. Today, we have the interesting pericope from Luke chapter 13. Herod, that old fox. I love the language here. You know, tell us what you got on your mind today. What are you thinking about preaching? And take us on into the text. Let's just let's talk for a few minutes here.
Well, the overarching theme in the text, in Luke's gospel here, as we're thinking about this, is remember Jesus has set his face for Jerusalem. You know, he's headed in. So every text has to do with Jesus heading to Jerusalem and people trying to warn him it might be a danger, somebody trying to stop him there. Watch for that dynamic going on. This is a journey story. Jesus headed to Jerusalem. Now, the people reading this, the early church reading this, they're aware, as we are, that this ends at the cross and the resurrection. And it's okay to keep that in mind. The writer had this in mind. He knew that people kind of knew the outline of the story. So there are hints throughout here that this is interpretive of the overall life, death, resurrection story of Jesus. So that's going on. And this is, this week, he is... It's about Herod and about Jerusalem and what's going on and what the dangers are as he goes forth.
I'm interested at the little curveball to me that opens the passage. We have Pharisees coming to Jesus, apparently concerned for him. Any notion what's going on here? Are they really concerned? Or, you know what? I'm not sure what to do with it.
Yeah. I think they are. And, the person who introduced me to this notion is Bishop Julian Gordy, who has been a guest on our show a time or two. And,
right.
And he makes a pretty good case that Jesus quite possibly himself was a Pharisee.
Yes. There are Pharisees who say that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that we see these stories and we make the Pharisees the bad guys.
Right.
But for Jesus, these were dialogue partners. They were much more like us than a lot of other characters in the story, at least those of us who are very active in church and involved in church and trying to do that. We're elder brothers. We are people who take faith seriously. You know, elder brother of the prodigal son.
Right. Story.
So these are people who are concerned for Jesus. They like him. They're arguing with him, but that's the way rabbis and disciples and all talk. They're sorting it out. They're sorting out what is the truth here. So I think this is one hint to us that we have maybe... looked at them askance in some ways, and that they're serious because they don't want him dead. And they got some insight, I think. Most of the Pharisees were connected with the scribes and some of the other leaders in Jerusalem, and they had their ear to the ground.
Right.
And well, Herod wanted to kill him.
That's it. Well, I did bring that up a little bit jokingly, but it illustrates a point. Sometimes they're going to be things in these scriptures that at least some of your people listening are going to say, wait a minute, I thought the Pharisees were always the bad guys. They were always Jesus' enemies. Not necessarily so. And so you may need to pay attention to those.
Well, and that may be a preaching entree point, is to say, sometimes things aren't what they appear.
That's
a way into this text, is to perk up their ears about the Pharisees being nice to Jesus. Well, another interesting thing I like in this text is playing around. There's two sections. Let me just put it this way. There are two sections to this text. The first one is 31 through 33. No, 31 and 32, which is this dialogue about Herod. And then 33 through 35 is about prophets in Jerusalem. But what ties them together for me is the fox in the first half and the hen in the second half.
You know, I just didn't catch that myself. How about that?
And I love the way Luke plays with that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a fox, and they'll tell that fox, and the fox is after him, and then you turn around, and you've got the hen as the brave one protecting, you know, as opposed to the hen being, you know, we think of a scared a chicken. What do we say? A chicken is the way we tell somebody they're
a cat. Yeah, you're chicken.
Running around like a chicken with his head cut off, but it, Jesus turns that image upside down and turns it into a brave image. So that's an interesting connectivity. There are a couple of references to third day. That's some of what I was talking about earlier about, you know, knowing the resurrection and issues before you read this, even though in the storyline, the chronology of the story, this is before Jesus' death and resurrection. The people in the story, except for Jesus, don't know that what the possibilities are going to be. But the writer knows, and the readers know. So on 32, that's another connector. He's got, I'll be casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. What did Jesus say on the cross? It is finished. This is foreshadowing here. And then you move to 33 and you got the same thing. Yet today, tomorrow, and the next day, I must be on my way. And this is where he segues to the business about connecting with Jerusalem. Now, today, tomorrow, and the next day is not literally he's got his calendar out figuring out when he can leave.
Right.
This is an idiomatic expression that says, soon, I need to leave. But it is a third day connection.
One of the ideas I've been working, actually during the season of Lent, I'm going to be team preaching with some of the folks in my church, and I'm very privileged to have some excellent associates that work with me, some part-time, some full-time. That's neither here nor there. Point being, we were talking through these scriptures the other day, and one of the ideas that we have found compelling is that the fact of time, it's ticking. Time is passing, and you know, almost like we were considering putting a visual image up on the pulpit as you begin the sermon of the hourglass with the sand, you know, dripping out. And so this is what this language does for us today, tomorrow, and then I've got to be on the way. The time is ticking. This appointment is coming. Jesus is very aware of it. It adds a dramatic element.
This is not something I would do,
right?
Because of my liturgical setting. I just think it. You know,
come on down to First Baptist Church and give it a try.
No, what I'm about to suggest. Mm-hmm. But the movie High Noon,
right?
If you take a look at it, it has this wonderful thing. There's the wall clock, and the movie takes place in an hour's time, and the clock is ticking at noon. From the very first scene, you know, at noon. The gang will get off the train, and they're going to kill. They pledge to kill the sheriff. He's got time to leave. He's asking people to help him with the whole movie, but he keeps coming back to the clock.
At high noon.
And he's a Christ figure in the sense of sacrifice on behalf of the unworthy sinners. He's not a Christ figure in the sense that he decided to kill the Romans rather than allow, you know,
crucifixion.
But there's that sense of that time ticking away. That'd be a nice kind of image you could do as you go through the sermon. And here comes another clock, tick, 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 and more time has gone.
Yeah. There's a great piece of gospel music trivia in the movie High Noon as well. And then one of the climactic scene where they walk into the saloon, and it's sort of classic, and the piano player's over in the corner, and, you know, the saloon door swings open, everything stops, including the music. What the piano player is playing is an old drinking tune, which for those of us who grew up in the gospel music tradition, learned as I have found a friend in Jesus. He's everything to me. Yeah, the lily of the valley.
Lily of the valley, yeah. Well, you know, Luther started that business.
I know. Got us in on using those drinking songs.
Popular music turned into Christian music. It moves along that, you know, that wonderful image. You can't do much to improve on verse 34. You know, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, and the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to it. And then that one line is just a beautiful image. And it teaches us one more time that less is more when it comes to description. A good description, tersely drawn, preaching and otherwise, is so much better than something overdone. And because people lose it. I have desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. That's all he said, and we've got it. And too often we put too much on it. I just want to, that's a little stylistic moment there.
Yeah, the you know, we talk about the aptly turned phrase, and it's more than just how to use words.
Yeah.
That's a perfect illustration, whereas our temptation, is many times. Now, another way to understand this is, and we sometimes just explain it to death.
We pile on too much, and we don't leave enough open-ended. That's the wonderful thing. You have to leave things where people can let their imagination go and set it up where they don't say, no, wait a minute, they're not arguing with you. Because they argue with you, they quit listening, but they can. You invite them in to start thinking about what this could be. So, but that image, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, calls up that whole image of a God who has been struggling from the creation to be in relationship with God's people. God's people are a people who more often run from God than run to God. And so as the kin's trying to gather her brood, what is the brood running to her? Or are they scattering? And she's trying to gather. And I think that's the image. And God's people have often been those who run from God. And then at times there are people who turn on God. That's the image. You know, then they turn on God. And the Moses in the wilderness, how often did the people turn on him and turn on God? And how often did the prophets get turned on? This is an image Jesus is calling up. But God keeps coming. God keeps coming. God keeps coming. That's the image of this text. Nothing's going to deter God in Christ from doing what God needs to be done. He's not going to turn and run. This is a core underneath this. He's going to keep coming. Going to keep coming. The hound of heaven.
Even in the stark language of verse 35, which makes a little bit of a turn, see, your house is left to you. You've left yourself unprotected. You're not willing. You've run away. You've
made your bed. Now.
Yeah, bad stuff's going to happen. But even then, verse 35 closes with a bit more foreshadowing. You won't see me until the time comes when you say, and he gives us the Psalm quote, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Most of our folks are going to get the reference to a few weeks from hence, Palm Sunday, entry into Jerusalem. Yeah. So, yeah, we have left ourselves unprotected. We have left ourselves at risk, but God keeps coming and will come. I like it.
Yep.
I like it. Well, anything else you want to say wrapping this up today? I do think it's important, as you've already mentioned to us and reminded us, the theme for Lent here, Jesus is on the way. We've talked about the clock ticking, Jesus being very aware of what's happening and the need to get to Jerusalem. He is inexorably drawn to Jerusalem, even though we still have a ways to go. And the fact that this is the God who just will not give up. I'm also aware that particularly for Lent, talking about most of the other people in the story really just don't have a clue what's going on. And so God's work in the world, the work of redemption, the work of salvation itself, doesn't really depend on us being aware, on even on us pleading for help. It is something that God is doing. It is all of God. We live in the midst of it, whether we're aware of it or not.
Well, language that is more common in a kind of Calvinist and Reformed tradition than Lutheran tradition is to talk about the sovereignty of God.
Right.
And I had a good friend, a college roommate, who spent many years as a Lutheran, probably because I was. He moved to a new town. There's a Lutheran church. Delmer's a Lutheran. Must be fine. And his wife died, and he remarried, and they started going to a kind of big community church that came out of that tradition. And he said, it's great. It's fine. I love it. And he said, but they talk about the sovereignty of God. Can you explain that to me? And the best I could do with that was to say, you know, it really doesn't depend on us ultimately. And that's what the sovereignty of God is about. We don't manipulate God. God saves us because God chooses to. And the human response is to embrace God and to trust God in the midst of this situation, and to trust that God is, if you trust that God is good, then you can trust the sovereignty of God. God chases us. We chase God until God catches us.
Oh, that's it. Kind of like the old, yeah. Oh gosh, what was the play? And then it was a movie years ago, Dog Patch.
Yeah.
Little Abner and Sadie Hawkins Day.
Yeah,
where
Sadie
it turns
Hawkins.
Around and women going to catch the men. Yeah. I'm on run till you catch
me. We chase God until God catches us.
There you go.
That's pretty much it.
I like it, Bubba. Best wishes to everybody. Going to be preaching on this second Sunday in Lent. We enjoy hearing from you all. And again, let us know something. Use our lectionarylab.com website, Facebook page, or just send us an email, john.fairless, or you can send it to delmer.chilton. We're both at gmail.com. Happy to hear from you. Bubba, not much left for us to do today other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Crawdad Stomp by Joshua Kirsch. We go out this session with a rare recording of a great blues banjo player, Uncle John Scruggs, from 1928, performing Little Log Cabin in the Lane, a tune that has become the basis of the gospel song, The Lily of the Valley.
Side by side in that little log cabin down the lane. Oh, diamond all gold.